This audio is from Gabriel Kuhn's talk, Soccer versus the State, given at the 2011 Anarchist Book Fair.
Hello, and welcome to the Anarchist Book Fair. Anybody who's just arrived, and if you haven't already, I encourage you to go down and check out the bookstalls after the talk. My name is Mark, I'm a member of the Workers' Solidarity Movement, and probably also worth mentioning and found the Bohemians and Blue of Ireland, given the nature of the talk. I'd like to introduce our speaker, Gabriel Kuhn, who will be speaking on the subversive side of football, and it's a side of football that we don't get to see on Sky Sports or even Monday Night Soccer. Gabriel's got to speak for about an hour, and after that we'll have roughly half an hour for questions and comment.
Thanks very much. Thanks for the invitation and the introduction. Thanks everyone for coming. I'm usually really good at keeping my talks to 45, 50 minutes or an hour. I've realized that I have bigger problems with the football talk. Last time in Bristol, I spoke for an hour and a half. I guess that's kind of part of the nature of starting to talk about football, but I'll really try to keep it to an hour this time, so we'll have a bit of time afterwards for questions and comments. I should say one thing before I forget, because I found that discussion on an Irish football forum before I came over here. People were irritated that the book is called Soccer versus the State, but not Football versus the State, because the sport's called football. And then it was kind of funny because there were comments where people wrote that, well, you know, the author is originally from Austria, you have to excuse him, he might not know. That is not the reason why the book is called Soccer versus the State. The reason is very simple. The publisher is a US-American publisher, and they wouldn't publish it otherwise. That's why the subtitle is Tackling Football and Radical Politics, so we try to find a compromise there. What I'll do now is I'll say a little bit, and I'll try to keep that really short, about my personal relationship to football, which will also explain, hopefully, why I got motivated to write this book, and then I'll present the contents of the book with the help of some images. As I said, I'm originally from Austria. I grew up in the western part of Austria, a region called Tyrol. Innsbruck is the capital. I was, as a kid, sports was pretty much the only thing that interested me, and I competed in different sports and then started focusing on football when I was 13, 14, not least because I was selected to play for the youth teams under 15 team of FC Tirol, which at the time was the best professional team in the region. I should also say this is the 1980s. Austrian football at the time was significantly better than it is today. The first season I played for FC Tirol, the under 15 team, they went to the UEFA Cup semi-final, something that's not only unthinkable today for the FC Tirol, but for any Austrian club, actually. After just 1 year playing in that youth team, I got a contract with a second league team in Austria, which is semi-professional, so the first league would be fully professional. And I played for that team for 4 years, and then I ended my football career when I was just 19 years old, partly because of personal reasons. I just wanted to do other things and travel, and football just took up too much time. But partly also because when I was 16, 17, I discovered radical politics as my new passion in life, which became more important than sports, and that created some kind of contradictions, I guess, or challenges with respect to me playing football on that level, which had to do with, I guess, a bunch of reasons that aren't that surprising. I mean, first of all, the club I played in, the sort of stereotypical locker room atmosphere that was very homophobic, very sexist, racist. That was definitely true in the club that I played in. The structure of the club was very authoritarian. Personal relations were really poor. There were lots of intrigues, and the influence of owners and sponsors on the game were also a problem, just because there were a lot of people who had a lot of power and could make a lot of decisions that influenced the club and the game in general, who actually weren't very interested in the game itself, but had either their local political interests or their their profit in mind. So out of all that, I decided not to pursue that football career any longer. And since then, so this is about 20 years ago, since then, I've always stayed in touch with football. I mean, I still like to play, I like to watch, I like to talk about football. And also, related to a lot of travels I did, I just met football in a lot of different circumstances in different countries and on different continents. And it was specifically one situation that I found myself in the early 2000s that first inspired me to write about football. That was when I spent a lot of time in the U.S. and discovered that football was really popular in anarchist and activist circles, which isn't that surprising given the history of football in the U.S., which has often been seen as a migrant sport, as a kind of liberal amateur sport, something different to the big professional leagues, the baseball, American football, and basketball, which is also a reason for it. It still being called a non-American or un-American sport by some conservative reporters or politicians in the States. So on the one hand, it was very exciting for me that you could go to anarchist gatherings and anarchist festivals and always play what was called anarchist soccer. On the other hand, my kind of European football elitism came through very strongly because I thought it was very exciting that all these people obviously liked football, but it seemed to me that they didn't really know how to play football, that they didn't know much about the history of football, about the politics of football. And so I decided to write what I called an anarchist soccer manual, which was a homemade zine of 48 pages, which was trying to kind of explain the relationship between football and politics, with a special focus on left-wing and radical politics. And that scene was the best-selling scene of all scenes I've ever done. I guess sold 5 times as many copies as the second best selling. And when, a few years ago, PM Press was founded, and the publisher that now brought out this book, and I started to discuss different publishing projects with them, we had the idea to take that scene and basically expand it into a book. And so this is how Soccer versus the State came into existence. What I did basically was expand the scene, update it, of course, but then especially also I used a lot of other material that I added. Reprints of articles, translations of articles on football and politics. There are some articles that I asked people to specifically write for the book, and then I did a bunch of interviews with different people who were involved in football, either as radical players or as radical supporters, or in a similar function. Roughly, the book has 3 parts. The first one is a political history of football, again with a focus on the kind of left-wing or on aspects that are specifically interesting for left-wing radical progressive activists. Part of that chapter is also a discussion of certain issues that often come up when football is discussed in left-wing circles, like the connections between football and nationalism, sectarianism, the commercialization, football as an opiate of the masses, and other questions. Bigotry in football culture, racism, homophobia, etc. The second part deals with what I in the book call radical interventions in football culture. So this is about players, managers with progressive left-wing ideals, clubs that kind of try to make a difference. There are many examples, but there are some within the world of organized professional football. And support, a radical supporter culture. And then the final part is about the kind of grassroots or DIY football culture that has developed in the last roughly 20 years and is now really contains sort of international networks with it's their own leagues and tournaments and clubs, which is also, I guess, has been it was a strong reaction to the ever increasing commercialization and professionalization of the game. So I'm going to go through these parts again, as I said, with the help of some images. A lot of these images are also in the book. Some aren't for copyright reasons or others. The history, of course, I mean, you could talk about just that for hours, so I'll just take a few examples, kind of a few steps, if you will, that seem politically interesting in the history of the game. This is Blackburn Olympic, FA Cup winner, 1883, is considered the first working class team that won the FA Cup. After school teams won, where the modern-day football, game of football kind of developed, before it became what a lot of people, you know, say is a working-class sport. Now, I think what's interesting with Blackburn Olympic is that already at the time, the team kind of expressed a certain tension around this assumption that football is a working-class sport that pretty much defines the history of football, which is that these players were working class folks, most of the people who watched and supported were working class folks, but the people who controlled the game and organized it and sponsored it weren't. I mean, even Blackburn Olympic at the time was sponsored by a factory owner. And so you'll always have, and people talk about, you know, also football as an originally working class sport, about the working class that has to reclaim football. It's not that that is entirely untrue, but it's a little more complicated than what it often seems, just because, as I said, there have always been other interests involved, especially in the organized professional game. These are the Dick Carroll ladies, the best women's team in England during World War I and shortly afterwards. Women's football became really popular in England during World War I when a lot of men were in war and couldn't play. That popularity continued after the war. There was a kind of legendary game in 1920 when the Dick Carroll ladies played the St. Helens ladies, the second best team in Liverpool, a crowd of 53,000 people, which I believe still stands as a record crowd for women's games in England to this day. A few months after the game, the English FA decided to ban all women's games from FA grounds in England, which basically meant that organized women's football couldn't be played anymore. A lot of other national FAs followed that example. And in many countries, including England and Germany, I don't know the exact situation in Ireland, but for example, England, Germany, many other countries, that ban was in existence until the 1970s, which meant that for a 50-year period, it was basically impossible to have organized women's football, which was a major reason for why football turned into a very, not that it wasn't a male-dominated sport at the time, but it became almost like an exclusive male domain. A lot has changed in the last 20, 25 years, but obviously the male dominance still remains. This is Club El Porvenir, a club that was founded in Argentina in 1915 by radical socialists. It's interesting what's interesting about clubs that were founded by radical socialists or syndicalists or anarchists at the time was that this goes to show that a certain conflict in the assessment of football within left-wing culture is no new phenomenon, but you know has been around for over 100 years. Even at the time where you had texts, and this is also documented in the book, with, for example, a text that was written by German syndicalists in the 1920s that really had this very strong opiate of the masses, sort of rejection of football, where people complained that workers go play and watch football on the weekend instead of organizing themselves politically. You already at the time had that other view where people said, well, football is popular with the working class or the working classes, and establishing rigorous control of football clubs helps actually the general organization of the working class, helps workers to have gathering places outside of the workplace, and in that sense can be a contribution also to raise the self-esteem of the working class, and can be a contribution to class struggle. I took the Argentinian example also because Argentina is kind of, there were a number of clubs founded in Argentina, like the Martyrs of Chicago in 1905, which later became the Argentinos Juniors, first professional club with Diego Maradona. But you have examples like that in various other countries. In Germany, there was a complete workers-controlled league in the 1920s. This is Arbeiterturnen Sportverein Oldendorf. So it was organized by the Arbeiterturn und Sportverband, so Workers Sports and Gymnastics Association. So this was a league that that existed alongside the official German FA administered league and was fully workers controlled, and was banned in 19. All these clubs that anti-association were banned in 1933 when the Nazis took over, as well as all Jewish clubs. Austria had a really good Jewish club, Pacua Vienna, which was also which had to which stopped existing when they were banned by the Nazis. Talking about football under the Hitler regime, this is a very embarrassing moment in the history of English football. It's from a game played in Berlin between Germany and England in 1938. By orders of the English FA, did the English players greet the German spectators with the Hitler salute. Here's another example of football under the Nazi regime. What's interesting about this is that the Nazis weren't really able to use football as a propaganda tool, which I think is difficult with football partly because it's very unpredictable. I mean, also if you look at the way that sports have been used in the Soviet Union or in Eastern Germany, which were very, very successful in many sports, through scientific sports programs and other means, like with football, that never really worked because I guess football is too unpredictable as a game. The Nazis stopped organizing national encounters altogether in 1942 after they lost in Berlin in front of 95,000 spectators to Sweden 2-3 in 1942. I live in Sweden now, so when I give these talks in Sweden, I usually also address the question why Sweden would have still sent a team to play in Germany in 1942, but that's a separate issue to discuss. When we talk about totalitarian regimes and are trying to use football for propaganda purposes, one, as I said before, like using the game itself or relying or hoping for successes of a national football team or whatever, it has been very difficult. However, directly manipulating the game, especially at the club level, was a very common way of authoritarian regimes with respect to trying to use football for political purposes. Simon Cooper, well-known English Dutch football journalist, has coined the term totalitarian football with respect to these practices, which you've had in most authoritarian regimes, whether that's Dynamo Berlin in East Germany or Colo-Colo in Chile under the Pinochet regime, or Hafia Conakry, which dominated African club football in the 1970s under the regime of Sékou Touré. Like, you had specific players allocated to those specific teams to create these kind of strong, prestigious club teams. Another kind of important chapter in the post-World War II development of football is the strong commercialization. You have different ways. The first one happened in the 1960s with also the increased presentation of football, transmission of football on television. This year's World Cup Willy, 1966 Men's World Cup in England, the first time that an official mascot was used and sold in various forms, which kind of has become today one of the main features of all kind of bigger tournaments and an expression of this kind of strong commercial aspect that football has today. Another aspect, this is an anecdote from Austrian football about the role that football, because of its, the role that football can play in a wider kind of social, political context because of the strong status that football has in many societies. And trying to make this short, I mean, Austrian identity has been a very difficult issue ever since the big empire broke up after World War I and the little modern-day Austria, that German-speaking republic was founded. Something that today no one wants to talk about in Austria, but after World War I, all parties except for the Communist Party instantly wanted Austria to become a part of Germany because people thought that Austria, at that size, wasn't able to survive. As I said, no one today wants to talk about this because of what happened, but Austria actually did join Germany in 1938. But it is a part of Austrian history. That kind of identity problem continued after World War I, especially with respect to Germany as the big kind of dominating German-speaking nation. Although it is kind of a strong thesis, but a lot of that changed on one day in 1978 at the World Cup in Argentina when Austria played against Germany and won 3-2, which goes as the biggest success of Austrian football in post-World War II history, which is interesting because that win didn't give anything to Austria because Austria had already was already out of the tournament before that final game. However, winning that game meant that Germany didn't advance to the semifinals. So with this kind of moment of emancipation over Germany, also the kind of modern national Austrian identity wasn't necessarily created as such, but it was a big contribution. Something that kind of illustrates this, I was happy when I found this headline online when I put the talk together for the first time. This is from an Austrian daily, a day after that game against Germany, and the headline says, fantastic 3-2 victory, Germany goes home. So this, again, illustrates the complicated relationship between Austria and Germany and the role that football kind of has played in this. Finally, sort of the last big wave of commercialization of football, if we look at probably the last 10, 15 years, what's often we call the modern football economy, again with TV playing a big role, also in changing everything from kick-off hours to the way that tournaments are organized and dates are set for different games. And then you also have this aspect of big football celebrity culture. With Mia Hamm, who's up there in the corner, I mean, that also has to say Mia Hamm had a big influence on the, played a big role in women's football becoming more popular, not only in the US, but also globally. And then you have David Beckham in a particularly interesting post. As I said, and in that first kind of part of the book, I then also discuss these questions a bit more about, you know, whether football is an opiate of the masses, and the competitive aspect also of football. And I guess to a lot of these arguments are critical arguments that left-wing activists have. I mean, there's a lot of validity to it, but I think in all these cases you can also look at, there are all these arguments that you can bring forward in support of the values that the game of football, seen under certain circumstances, can have, like values of cooperation, the sort of universal language character that football has because of its popularity that allows people to kind of join and meet despite language or cultural or other barriers. It would take way too much time to go into all this now. I just take one example that I think shows that kind of ambivalence very well, which is the example of nationalism, which often comes up. In fact, I honestly think when you discuss the question of nationalism in respect to football, the discussion at the end of the day is not very different from very general discussions you have about nationalism within the left. I mean, on the one hand, there's the clear criticism that embracing a national identity very often leads to rather reactionary political projects. On the other hand, you also have that moment of embracing national identity as part of an anti-colonial or anti-imperialist struggle, which a lot of people on the left think is a positive thing. To illustrate that kind of conflict in the football world, this year is a kind of legendary picture from a Dinamo Zagreb against Zvezda Belgrade game from 1990, when Slovenian Boban kicked a Serbian, a Croatian star player, kicked a Serbian policeman. Just recently, someone told me that apparently the only reason why Boban did that was because he recognized one of his relatives among the Dinamo Zagreb supporters who were beaten up by the police, and not because he wanted to make a big pro-independence statement for Croatia. Nonetheless, it became a legendary picture. At the time, this was still Yugoslavia, and Boban was banned from playing for a few months and kind of became a national Croatian hero overnight. And then in the 1990s, when the Croatian national, when Croatia became independent, the Croatian men's team had a lot of success in football. That success was used clearly for propaganda purposes of a very authoritarian regime under Tuchman. So this would kind of be one of the examples of football playing a negative role in supporting or strengthening an authoritarian nationalist regime. On the other hand, we have examples like the Algerian football team that was formed in 1958 before Algeria actually became independent. There's an interesting history to the formation of the team, because most of the players who were in the team at the time were playing as professionals in France, and in a coordinated effort, they left their clubs and their French cities the same night and all went to Tunis in Tunisia, where the headquarters of the Algerian Liberation Front, National Liberation Front, were at the time. And so they formed this team, which then sort of served as an ambassador for Algeria and the Algerian liberation struggle, and arguably had played a significant role in the liberation struggle that a couple of years later actually did lead to Algeria's independence. Similar issues, you can look at the problem of sectarianism, I guess, similarly. Like, there's just two different angles. This is an example from so-called sectarian football problem that is cited the most often. So this is Glasgow with Celtic Glasgow representing the Irish Catholic community, and Glasgow Rangers, the Protestant British. This is from the riot after the cup final in 1980. Obviously, also that situation is more complicated than what a lot of people saying that the rivalry between these two clubs contributes significantly to general ongoing sectarianism in Glasgow and beyond. But again, very often this is used as a negative example. On the other hand, you do have clubs that formed around ethnic or communal identities that have clearly played a positive role for those communities. This is Türkiyespor Berlin, which was founded in 1978 by Turkish immigrants in Germany and really contributed significantly to the integration of Turkish community in Berlin. Then many other Türkiyespor clubs were founded not only in Germany but also beyond. In Sweden, where I live now, there's an interesting example in the town of Södertälje, which is south of Stockholm, which has the worldwide biggest community of Assyrians, who in the 1970s founded two clubs, Syrianska and Assyriska. Syrianska is now playing at the top Swedish league, and those two clubs also have played a very important role in the integration of that community in Swedish society. Finally, one example, I just use that as an anecdote to illustrate how complicated, especially when we also speak of national identity and migration, national ethnic identity, how complicated issues can get. In Germany, the nationalism debate is in many ways very complicated. This is an image that I took, or a friend of mine took in Berlin during the last World Cup, a men's World Cup in South Africa. This is a house in Berlin-Kreuzberg. So it says still hailing Germany, and the lower banner reads German troops out of Africa. So this is referring to the German team and its supporters. And you see a lot of these banners in Germany. in a left-wing neighborhoods during World Cup events. You also see these kind of pictures. This is from Berlin-Neukölln, a district next to Kreuzberg. What people, I don't know how familiar people here are with this, but in Germany, during those World Cups, in left-wing bars, very often you get free drinks if you bring in German flags. So, you know, people have those little German flags on their cars, and if you take 10 of those flags and bring them to a left-wing bar, you get a free beer. If you take a flag from a balcony, that's, you just need one and you get a free drink. And so there are different websites and they give points to different flags. And so this flag, which was the biggest that people saw, I don't know exactly what people offered, but it was like, if you bring in this flag, you and your friends can drink all night for free or whatever. So this flag was taken 3 times and always replaced. What made the whole thing particularly complicated then was that the flag belonged to these two fellows who aren't German but Lebanese. They have been living in Germany for over 10 years, but they don't have a German citizenship. And then so this was all was blown out of proportion, and became a big media thing because left-wing activists were accused of attacking immigrants and were accused of always complaining that there is too little integration in Germany, but then when immigrants actually try to integrate, they don't like that either. And it became a kind of classical German example of the complications of national identity in the football context. The last picture, this is just to illustrate the first part to that, what I've called bigotry in football culture before, so the problems of racism, sexism, homophobia. This is also kind of an iconic image, John Barnes kicking away a banana during his time as a Liverpool forward. The reason why this image became so famous was because it looks like he has done this many times before, and it's a very casual reaction to this racist insult that was not only characteristic for English football at the time, but for football in many European countries, and it remains to this day, although also on that front a lot of things have changed in the last 20-25 years, not least because of initiatives that started on a grassroots supporters level. I'll get to that later. This actually brings me to the second part that I want to talk about, which is in the book, which has to do with kind of left-wing, or the attempt to put forward left-wing radical ideas in the world of football. There are 3 different categories that you could divide this into. One is political activists using football as a stage for bringing out, for transporting certain political messages. Then people within the game, as I said before, players, managers who try to make a difference, and then supporter culture. First, a couple of examples for the kind of activist involvement in football. One of the first bigger events where this became very obvious was during the Men's World Cup in Germany in 1974, a very kind of still politicized community in Germany that used that event as a means for political protest. This is a poster. I don't know how well people can recognize this from a distance, but there is you have a policeman at the top, and then you have the demolition of a squad in the middle, and then you have the football, and then it says Berlin has a bullet for everyone. The kind of most spectacular action that happened during the World Cup was when activists stormed onto the field during the Germany-Chile encounter in protest against military dictatorship in Chile. Speaking of Latin American military dictatorships, there was a lot of organizing around the 1978 Men's World Cup in Argentina, which was played under military dictatorship. It's also interesting because to this day, there's a lot of debate within the left, also the Argentinian left, whether the fact that Argentina won that World Cup contributed to the military dictatorship staying in power a bit longer than it would have otherwise, because that success was used for propaganda purposes by the regime, or whether that success actually contributed to the downfall of the military regime not too long after the World Cup. The argument there is that through the mass celebrations that people experienced after the victory, there was also a sense that if you reach a critical mass that is out on the streets and does things together with a lot of passion, you get to a point where that passion and that activity can no longer be controlled even by a military regime, and it kind of killed the feeling in folks that you could, in a collective effort, also overthrow this regime. But as I said, that's kind of like a thesis among many regarding the Argentina World Cup. And then this is just one example of something that has happened continuously in football history, which is just using football arenas to, you know, put up political banners. This is an example from Sweden, the club in Gothenburg. David Isak is a Swedish Eritrean journalist who has been imprisoned in Eritrea for some years, and so activists brought out this banner for David Isak. Interestingly enough, the club was fined by the Swedish FA because they didn't remove the banner, because the Swedish FA, like a lot of other FAs around the world, don't want political messages in their stadiums. There was an appeal, and then the club never had to pay that fine, but it goes to show what the attitude of a lot of FAs still is with respect to very innocent, harmless political activism. There were other examples. I don't know, people who maybe watched the 1982 Men's World Cup in Spain, whenever Poland played, Solidarność banners came up, but the Guardia Civil took them down almost within 30 seconds, so they were very effective. And then there's other examples. What can also be seen as part of this are social justice campaigns around football. This is that was a pretty strong campaign by the International Labour Organization against the involvement of child labor in the production of footballs in India and Pakistan. Some companies then started to have certificates on their balls that kind of meant to prove that there was no child labor involved in the production of those balls. And then you have, in the context of sweatshop, anti-sweatshop campaigns, also Nike and other companies were targeted for the production of soccer-related goods in sweatshops. So this is a so-called billboard improvement, the most offensive boots we've ever made, 100% slave labor. And then, of course, there's been various campaigns around FIFA, which is a very non-democratic organization that is very profit-oriented, to say the least. Especially with respect to the last Men's World Cup in South Africa, there was a lot of activism because, I guess, in South Africa, just that kind of the conflict between FIFA and related companies making a lot of money off of the World Cup in the country where still in many parts and regions where basic infrastructure is missing, just kind of made that contradiction very obvious. And we had these campaigns, again, where the FIFA logo for the World Cup was manipulated, and it says "for the love of the game" instead of "for the love of the game" and "football and free market incorporated." There's similar other images, and there was actually really a lot of activism, not only in South Africa, but also in other countries. Then the second kind of group, as I said before, some players, managers, clubs that try to make a difference, sort of interesting at least for left-wing progressive football fans. There aren't that many. There's some. There's just a selection of Bill Shankly, legendary so-called socialist manager in England, very successful as a Liverpool manager. The 70s, Joao Saldanha, which is there to the upper right, coached the Brazilian team and led the Brazilian team to the 1970 Men's World Cup in Mexico, but then wasn't allowed to travel there because of the military dictatorship, who didn't want a communist to manage to represent the country. Then the lower right corner, Cesar Luis Menotti, who was the coach for Argentina at the 1978 World Cup when Argentina won. became kind of a left-wing hero when, after the victory, he refused to shake hands with Videla, the junta leader. And then you have George Csébes, who was the coach of a very successful Hungarian team in the 1950s, who was a communist and always explained the success of the Hungarian team with the fact that he had been able to transform the ideals of communism onto the football field. Rightfully, in a recent review that was published, it was pointed out that it's kind of odd to have Csébes in this book, since he was a Stalinist and was a Stalinist regime and whatnot. I can see all that criticism. I still think the idea that you create a successful football team by trying to, on the basis of communist ideals, was interesting enough to include them in the book. Here are some players: Ewald Lienen. Was a German, so this is the upper left corner, in the 1970s, vegetarian union organizer, sort of rebel figure in German football. Next to him is Ruben Svensson, played for IFK Göteborg in the 1970s, IFK Gothenburg in Sweden, and wrote columns for Politan, which is the journal of the communist newspaper of the Communist Party. Lower left corner, Matthias Schindler, Austrian player who refused to play for the German national team after Austria was annexed by Germany in 1938. Then Luca Relli, kind of famous communist forward from Italy, is now playing for Napoli. And then Sócrates. I'll say something about Sócrates, Brazilian player, famous player in the 1980s, in a second, in the context with a project that he was involved in with his club, Corinthians, São Paulo, in the early 1980s. The upper right corner, you have Volker Ipik, who is maybe the kind of most legendary radical player. He's a goalkeeper for São Paulo in the 1980s, when São Paulo started to have a really strong left-wing anti-fascist fan base, and he was the only player who somehow represented that spirit, since he had lived in squads and had traveled to Nicaragua as a volunteer after the revolution, and he kind of became this mythical figure among radical football fans. And then, of course, you have figures like Diego Maradona, who deserves his own image, not only because he's so famous, but because it's a good photo, or so I think. What's interesting with people like Maradona, who doesn't only have the Diego, the Che Guevara tattoo, but also Fidel Castro tattoo, and has been seen at anti-imperialist rallies and wearing anti-Bush shirts, is that if you look at the lifestyle side of things of these people, it's sometimes hard to kind of embrace them as very credible left-wing activists. And that's, Maradona is just a very famous example. There are others where a lot of these contradictions are obvious. This is Democracia Corinthiana, what I mentioned before, Corinthians club in Sao Paulo. And one of the very few examples where in the early 1980s, players of the club really became politically active and not only opposed the military dictatorship in Brazil at the time, but also tried to contribute to democracy within not only their own club, but the organization of football in Brazil in general. Was successful and very influential for about 2 years, and then some of the key players who led that campaign, like Sócrates or Casagrande, left and played for other clubs, or also left and played in Europe, and that campaign ended. But it's to this day probably the most interesting attempt by players to really make an active political difference within professional football. With other clubs, it's more difficult. I mean, even with the much-loved FC St. Pauli, people selling FC St. Pauli shirts just opposite my stall now with the book fair. The problem is that when St. Pauli is referred to, as you can often read, an anti-fascist football club or a radical football club, it's kind of misleading. I mean, what's special about São Paulo is the radical supporter culture. The club itself is not very different from most other football clubs, neither presently nor historically. I mean, there have been campaigns that fans were involved in against, for example, the name of the stadium, which for a long time carried the name of a former São Paulo president, Wilhelm Koch, who was an industrialist who got rich during the Nazi regime because of property that had been expropriated from Jewish owners. There are other examples. Recently, someone in Hamburg told me that one of the former sponsors of St. Pauli has some kind of connection, has some kind of Nazi history as well. This is interesting in the sense that some radicals in Hamburg are so irritated with the kind of St. Pauli hype and St. Pauli myth that they've become militantly anti-St. Pauli and now support mainly Altona 93. So it is a kind of complicated issue. However, as far as fan culture and supporter culture is concerned, St. Pauli is a very unique example. I mean, basically, shortly what happened, for those of you who do not know, in the 1980s, when St. Pauli became a kind of main site of the German housing struggles, squatting struggles, a lot of the squatters in the area started to go and watch football at FC St. Pauli. I mean, also St. Pauli being the kind of harbor area of Hamburg with the kind of whole sort of red light district, small time mythology, I guess, also played a part in creating the St. Pauli football legend, if you will. But basically, so these squatters and punks started going to watch St. Pauli and took over the supporters' culture and created this very strong sort of radical anti-fascist supporter culture around the club. And that is definitely, you know, unique and very positive and has played a big role in now the last part of the second chapter in the book that I'm talking about, which is the radical supporter culture. This is a photo from the founding congress of BAF, Bündnis Antifaschistischer Fußballfans at the time, so Alliance of Anti-Fascist Football Supporters. Which was renamed shortly afterwards to Alliance of Active Football Supporters because people wanted to be a bit more open to folks who are not already politicized. There's still a lot of debate about whether it was a good decision or not. But what's interesting I find about this picture particularly is that this, if you go to any kind of autonomous radical congress in Germany, this is what it looks like, only that all the banners here have some kind of relation to football. One of the earliest campaigns of BAF, and I should also say this, I think to this day, radical supporter culture in Germany is also unique. There isn't, I don't know of any country where you have that level of organized radical supporter culture. And BAF specifically was kind of an organization that remains at the core of radical fan organizing, has led many successful campaigns. This was one of the earliest, just a couple of months after founding the organization. Was a campaign against a friendly football match that was supposed to be played in Berlin between Germany and England on the 20th of April. The problem with that was that the 20th of April is Adolf Hitler's birthday, especially at the time with a really strong neo-fascist and nationalist movement in Germany that also organized strongly around football. Radical fans thought that it wouldn't be a good idea to have that game on that day, and started a really strong campaign. So this is from a demonstration that only happened 11 days before the game, when the game was still officially on, and eventually it wasn't played because the German FA considered it too risky. So this was one of the first big successes of BAF. There are several others that could be named, also especially in relation to all-seating stadiums where Germany has much less all-seating stadiums also than many other countries because there's been a lot of resistance. And then there were other groups that emerged kind of out of the BAF context. This is FIN, Frauen Fußball, Women in Football, which is an organization for women players and also specifically women football fans. Queer Football Fan Clubs, despite the name, this is also a German initiative, a network of queer football fan clubs. These are some examples from German arenas. This is Darmstadt Ultras, choreography against sexism, sexism sucks, football is for you and me. This is from Bremen, choreography against homophobia. This is also from Bremen, infamous youth. This is a very active left-wing supporter group there. So this is a choreography against racism. Of course, there are examples also from other countries. In England in the 1980s, there was a lot of organizing around the neo-fascist right-wing influence on supporter culture with organizations like Anti-Fascist Action and the Anti-Nazi League, which were successful in that campaign as well. This is an example from Holland, The Hague, anti-fascist organizing on the football grounds. Legata Autonoma Libanese, radical left-wing fan group at AS Libano, which also has a really strong left-wing support culture. And then some groups like here for Rayo Vallecano, Arrow of the Working Class, there is this kind of use the sort of reputation of football as a working class sport also for their identity as radical working class supporters. Say something real quick about the ultra phenomenon, which I guess historically goes back to the 1960s, at least in Italy, but probably has been a more well-noticed phenomenon in the last 10, 15 years in European football stadiums and now also especially in North Africa and in some ultra groups in Latin America. What's interesting politically with ultra groups, just to say real quick, I mean, what are ultra groups or how do they distinguish themselves and what's the difference between them and other supporter groups? I mean, the main kind of visible aspect is that they are very well organized in stadiums, are very visible, loud. So here you have these choreographies, upper left corners from Marseille, South Winners, and then this lower right corner is Sampdoria, Genoa in Italy. Pyrotechnics are kind of a big part of ultra culture. Again, ultra groups are very well organized. And ultra groups, and this is something that really divides them also from what's often generally referred to as hooligan culture, whatever, very difficult term. But in any case, ultra groups are really very dedicated to the game of football and get very involved also in the organization of their clubs and the generally the way the game is going, which is interesting politically. I mean, there are some ultra groups that are decidedly left-wing and anti-fascist, organized in networks like the Alerta Network or Antifa Ultras. There are unfortunately also some ultra groups that are decidedly right-wing. The vast majority of ultra groups is decidedly non-political, which I guess to them mainly means that they don't want to be affiliated with a particular political ideology, let alone a particular political party or organization. Interestingly enough, most of those groups are engaged in campaigns and projects that pretty much everyone would consider political. The problem, and some, and I'll say something about that in a second, some really meet with left-wing campaigns and organizing. The problem, or the reason why it's hard to kind of embrace the ultra phenomenon as left-wing phenomena, is because there are elements in pretty much all ultra groups, or most ultra groups, that are very problematic. One is a really strong sense of loyalty to their club, a kind of sense of territorialism, where you sort of not only own your stadium or your terraces, but also specific spots where you put up your banners, and if someone else puts up a banner there, it's a huge crime. Very often, internally, these groups are very hierarchical and authoritarian. However, there are certain aspects, as I said, where ultra-activism, if you will, and left-wing activism meet. One is around the issue of repression. Ultras have a lot of problems with the police and other figures of institutional authority, and you have these campaigns. A lot of ultras also get prison sentences, and then you have these campaigns. I mean, just image-wise, this could be any kind of left-wing prisoner support campaign. It's for, you know, freedom for the ultras. There was one campaign specifically in relation to Santos Mira Sierra, Olympique Marseille supporter who got sentenced to 3.5 years in prison in Spain after a minor scuffle, or not even a riot, on the stands when Marseille played Atlético Madrid in a European Cup game. And And that was a really European-wide campaign for getting Santos free for a couple of years. One thing, this is from a campaign at the Men's European Championship in Switzerland in Austria in 2008. One of the reasons why ultra-organizing and left-wing organizing also meets around issues of repression is because of many of the so-called hooligan laws where, for example, the Schengen Agreement on the continent can be temporarily suspended so that certain people cannot travel from one country to the other as they usually allowed to as EU citizens. All these kind of laws have also been used in connection with political protests and political organizing. So this is one of the reasons why there's a lot of collaboration. The other area where there is collaboration is the field of critique of commercialism and professionalism. Within ultra culture, this is the most kind of common slogan against modern football. The problem with this is that on the one hand, I mean, the anti-commercial aspect is good, the kind of implied romanticization of a supposedly better or purer football past is problematic, because even though football might have been less commercialized many decades ago, it had other problems that partly that haven't at all disappeared, but that have partly been alleviated. Like if you look at most football grounds, even just 30 years ago, I mean, in Europe, they're almost exclusively male, almost exclusively white. So there were really strong forms of social exclusion that have partly changed. Unfortunately, they've been replaced by other forms of social exclusion, mainly along economic lines. But anyway, The fact that things are kind of changing and developing, I think, from a progressive political perspective, I mean, that in itself is not a problem. The question is how these things develop. And I think also within football activism, so to speak, there should be a bigger focus on influencing the development of football rather than kind of glorifying a past that maybe was never that glorious. Just to kind of illustrate this, there was a strong campaign around about Austria Salzburg, which turned into Red Bull Salzburg, a team that's not particularly popular in Dublin either, at least among Bohemian supporters. Basically, what happened is that Red Bull took over Austria Salzburg in 2005 as a sponsor, changed the name from Austria Salzburg to Red Bull Salzburg. One must also know Austria Salzburg is one of the so-called traditional teams of Austria, which has a really long history. It was founded in the early 20th century. They also changed the colors of the club from white, purple to red, blue colors. So white, red, and blue. And then you had, again, a campaign that started in Austria, became Austria white, but then went beyond Austria, a really strong kind of anti-Red Bull campaign. So you had these kind of banners, fuck Red Bull, which I guess is fine. And then you also had, I'm not going to translate all these now, these are all banners from Austrian Stadia. All of them include something with tradition. One at the lower right corner also ties tradition to nation. And this kind of whole campaign that I think as an anti-commercial, anti-corporate campaign is a good campaign, in some circles turned into this really, really strange kind of traditionalist Austrian campaign that had a lot of very difficult, problematic political implications. Some other slogans that I think are good, I don't know if people can read this, but it says, "Ultras football is for you and me, not for fucking industry." I guess that's okay. This is a sticker from BAF, the German fan network, which basically means yuppies, go watch golf. Very straightforward, class war sticker, capitalism, still in football. Then you have just a lot of people know about the resistance of fans of Manchester United against the increased corporatization of the club, which ended in the founding of the FC United of Manchester. A very similar thing happened actually in Salzburg. Austria Salzburg was refounded, so to speak, after the club became Red Bull Salzburg by fans and started in the lowest Austrian amateur league. I think has been promoted now 5 years in a row. So that was a successful project. Unfortunately, on a sports level, it hasn't gone so well for Stirling Albion since they were taken over by their supporters, but it was the first team on that professional level in Europe that was taken over by its supporters, turned into basically a cooperative just a year ago, finally. And there are more campaigns in different European countries where fans do try, like in Germany, for example, Fortuna Köln supporters try to basically buy the club and run it themselves. And so this is an interesting phenomenon, which also leads to the third part, and I make this short, so I keep my promise of not talking more than an hour, even though I think I've already talked an hour, but it'll be short. This is the third part in the book where I talk about this kind of grassroots DIY football culture, which partly also emerged in as a response to the ever increasing kind of commercialization of the game. I think what a lot of people there focus on are the kind of aspects that often are named as sort of positive aspects within football, values that kind of fit into general broad left wing values, like the communal aspects of the game, the fact that you need cooperation to be successful, health aspects, and others. There are some leftist movements where football actually has played a fairly significant role and has been generally embraced. The Zapatista movement is one of them. This is a picture from Chiapas that was taken by a member of the Eastern Cowboys and Cowgirls alternative football club in Bristol when they toured Chiapas and played different games. This is another picture that I got from that person, which is from their tour. The clubs, they're different. Also in this part of the book, my text is relatively short, and I mainly interview people who are involved in this kind of alternative football culture, either part members of alternative grassroots football teams or organized tournaments. Some of these teams are here, the Eastern Cowboys in Bristol, Autonomous FC from Sao Paulo, FC Volga from Lithuania. There are, right, this is an example that illustrates that it's not an entirely new idea to have alternative football clubs. I was excited, I was doing work on something completely different in an archive in Switzerland a few years ago, and I found this picture of the FC Bakunin, which played in the Sunday League in Zurich already in the 1970s. More recent examples, I talked in the beginning about my experience with anarchist football in the States. They're just some illustrations of the early 2000s. There was an anarchist football association. It reads, if I can't play soccer, I don't want any part of your revolution. That's a spin-off of that famous dance quote by Emma Goldman. Matches and Mayhem, so tournament, anarchist gathering that was played in Chicago for a few years. People also often call these like soccer festivals and not tournaments, which I guess is politically more sound. Then there are like anarchist versus communist soccer matches that were organized in different parts of the States as well. This is internationally just a few of the tournaments or festivals that are organized in Belfast. There is since a few years an anti-racism World Cup is organized. In Germany, there are many such tournaments. One of the most popular is the Antifa Soccer Cup in Lünen. At the anti-GA protests in Japan in 2008, there was a football cup organized by the Football and Rage Collective, they call themselves. The probably best known example among the Allianz Assisti in Italy, which has been organized for more than 10 years, which now has over 100 teams that are both like to play football, obviously, but also engaged in different forms of political activities. You get different prices at the tournament, not only if you win football games, but also for your political work. And this is a picture that I got from Repubblica Internazionale, a socialist football team from Leeds in England, who are also represented in the book with an interview. Then there is at the end of that chapter in the book, I also talk a little bit about the possibilities of dealing with what's a common criticism, even of alternative soccer culture, that you can't get over that competitive aspect in football, which is just kind of contradicts to some people left-wing ideals. And I mean, people have dealt with that problem in various ways. There are different forms of playing that would help you, or that help avoid leaving the pitch with winners and losers, which, for example, the easiest way is that you swap players while you play someone who scores and starts playing for the opposite team. So at the end, you always have two teams playing, but at the end, there are no specific winners or losers. There's the sort of kind of famous three-sided football where there's always two teams playing against one and they shift all the time. So again, at the end of the game, you don't have any clear winners or losers. There are even now phenomena like freestyle football or Capoeira football, which is more kind of like an art forum and you don't actually play games. To me personally, all this is interesting. I don't have such a big problem with two teams playing against one another and one winning and one losing. For me, the more interesting aspect is how winning and losing a football game then translates into your status in the community. Like, that's the kind of, I guess, more important challenge maybe in that context. Just the last couple of pictures, because the last part of the book is a kind of extensive sort of collection of football-related material that might be of interest to left-wing progressive activists or football fans. So there's a list of different books. Les Enragés du Football, a French book, is actually really interesting. It's about the involvement of professional footballers in the protest movements in France in the late 60s. There's a whole bunch of really interesting movies on football, especially documentaries. Unfortunately, many of them aren't readily available in the English-speaking world, but they're After the Cup, for example, is a documentary about Bnei Sakhmi, a Palestinian team which won the Israeli Cup in 2004 and then also went on to represent Israel in the European Cup competition, which was a big political issue, not only in the Middle East, but beyond. Football Undercover is a documentary about a women's football team in Berlin-Kreuzberg, which also has kind of taken on some kind of ambassador role, both for women's rights and integration, and went on to travel to Iran and play games there, various other examples. And then there is, of course, the music influence of football, Los Fastidios. I think they're going to play even at the anti-racism World Cup in Belfast this year, kind of. Especially well known for the song Antifa Hooligans, which is very popular among that kind of crowd. Music for the Terraces is a sampler from Buff in Germany. There was a lot of usage by Buff, so the radical or progressive supporters network of popular culture. Ash used the famous Cantona kick against the Crystal Palace supporter. Bob Marley was a big football fan. And then The Scientist Wins the World Cup is my favorite football-related record cover. So that's why I have it with me. I'm done. Not much more than an hour. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
More podcasts like this one can be found at our website at www.wsm.ie.